Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Mitchell James Kaplan. Mitchell James Kaplan studied English literature at Yale University, where author William Styron encouraged him to become a novelist. Currently, he resides in Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania, with his wife and two children. Mr. Kaplan plays classical and jazz flute and is a licensed private pilot. He'll be reading from his first novel, By Fire, By Water, published by Other Press. Welcome to Prosody, Mitchell.
Thank you, Ellen.
How about we start out with you reading for a little bit?
Sure. This is a passage that falls near the end of my book. By the time he reached the port, a light drizzle was falling. The wharves teemed with voyagers, vendors of amulets, priests offering Jews a last chance to choose baptism, thieves, border officers whose impossible task was to inspect every emigrant for contraband materials, including coins. Those suspected of exporting gold or silver were taken to nearby homes, ordered to remove their clothes, inspected head to toe, sometimes raped, occasionally murdered. Scholars, moneylenders, and barbers who had never seen the sea toted heavy trunks up wobbly gangplanks. Parents called to their children, cousins clasped their cousins, uncles their nephews, brothers their brothers, bidding each other farewell forever. Through this tangle of human distress, Luis de Santangel wandered like a drunkard searching desperately for his home in the wrong town, losing any hope of finding Judith, increasingly prepared if he found her to follow her onto any ship bound for any destination. Finally, he saw her, wandering alone some distance away, looking fragile and wet. His heart pounding, he pressed further into the throng. In his haste, he bumped into a large man in a fez and almost fell. Scrambling to his feet, he looked where Judith had been. When he again caught sight of her, she was standing before a three-masted galleon, seeking shelter from the rain, shivering, rubbing her arms. He quickened his pace, almost running. As he approached, she seemed to see him, but so briefly he could not be certain. He thought he must have been mistaken, for she turned and walked in the opposite direction. The chancellor called her name, but in the hubbub of shouting mothers and children, authorities trying to maintain some semblance of order, sailors rigging the ships, she did not hear him. He hurried along the docks. When he caught up with her, he gently took her arm. She stopped and turned. Her eyes traveled down his face to his graying beard, his modest clothes, his hand on her arm. Why are you here? Her voice was low, perplexed, cold. This is no place for the Chancellor of Aragon, a Christian, third generation. She removed his hand. I came to see you at my first opportunity. Your first opportunity, she repeated incredulously. Señor Colón didn't speak with you. I sent my nephew. They spoke, but I've been in a jail of sorts, Santangel smiled a little nervously. Now I'm out. She observed his sunken cheeks, the beard he had grown, the note of humility in his pleading half-smile, a humility Judith had never seen in him. In jail? The powerful Chancellor of Aragon? Better to have no power and some security, or at least an illusion of security. What good is an illusion? Asked the fruit merchant's daughter. Santangel's thirsty eyes drank in her presence, her black sopping hair, her eyelashes, her lips, her clothes clinging to her body. Then he noticed it, the firm, well-defined roundness of her belly. She placed a hand on it. His eyes rose to meet hers. He swallowed. Their regard communicated what their mouths could not. Their child. Together, half deliberately, they had tied a knot. I've had time to think, explained Santangel. I've done a great deal of thinking, praying, remembering. He glanced at the slate-gray sea. I spent hours calling up every detail. He delicately ran his hand along the rim of her ear, down her cheek, under her jaw. From the first words I heard you pronounce. She removed his hand from her face, but held his forearm. What were they? Allah alone conquers. The inscription on those beakers that you made for the vizier. Yes, she nodded with a nostalgic smile. Allah alone conquers. Even the most powerful of us, we have little control over our destiny. Then our only choice is to embrace that destiny. Embrace it. Look around, Chancellor. Look around. Exiles all around them, some emaciated from long travels, many filthy, tried to board ships, pleaded with sailors, appealed to authorities. As he observed all this despair, Luis de Santangel felt more powerless than ever. His mind reviewed his years in the royal court, the perfidy of some, the loyalty of others, the sacrifices, the battles, the triumphs, the fears, the losses. For what good? No, Chancellor, our only choice, said Judith, is not to embrace our destiny in this world, but to hope for a better world. Her eyes glided to the galleon behind him. Then I shall accompany you into that world.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Mitchell James Kaplan, reading from his novel By Fire, By Water, published by Other Press. So Mitchell, the first thing is maybe you could kind of talk with us. This is a novel that's set in a historical time period, about what's happening in that time period and also what drew you to write about this time period.
The idea, I guess the germ of the idea came to me when I was sitting in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris many years ago, and I was just reading. I used to sit there all day reading, and I came across a book that listed all the sailors who sailed with Christopher Columbus and where they came from and what they did prior to sailing with him and where they ended up later. And I was intrigued by several of the stories of the sailors. It just got my imagination going, and I started to read more about the period, and it became obvious to me that I had never heard the true story of the context of the world from which Christopher Columbus had set sail, which was the end of the Middle Ages, a whole social order just destroying itself, collapsing, the world falling to pieces just prior to the discovery of the New World. And it was falling to pieces for reasons that had a lot of resonance for me in terms of things that are happening in our world today. I'm not saying that we're repeating the same cycle, but it had to do with religious strife. It had to do with cultures not able to hear each other and understand each other. And I just felt that that story had to be told, because the story that people have learned over the centuries about Christopher Columbus is just so narrow and focused and literally, very false because of all that it excludes.
Sure. And so in choosing to write this story, first off, you have to, I'm sure, do a ton of research. I mean, you could do a lifetime of research on this subject. So you had to kind of figure out that path. And then you also had to figure out who was going to be your guide through it all. And, you know, there are historical novels that choose to create a character that didn't really exist, and then those who choose to follow a person. So with Santangel, what was it that drew you to him?
The first draft was not, he was not the main character.
Interesting.
In the first draft, it was told from the point of view of one of the sailors on Columbus, a young boy who was growing up in Granada, a Jewish boy growing up in an Islamic emirate, in the south of Spain, all of which will be destroyed by the end of the book, and he'll end up in the New World. And Columbus actually left 40 sailors behind, and he was one of them. And so the first draft was from his point of view, but it was a very narrow point of view, because here's a boy growing up in basically a very circumscribed quarter within a part of Spain that is cut off from the rest of Europe pretty much by then. And he couldn't have that bird's eye view that I ended up wanting, which is, you know, this big tableau. And as I was writing it and doing my research, first research, then writing, then doing more research and so forth, I came across this kind of mind-blowing character of Luis de Santangel, who was the Chancellor of Aragon, the kingdom of which King Ferdinand was the king. And this Chancellor of Aragon, not only did he come from a family of converts who had converted from Judaism to Catholicism a couple of generations earlier, and who were suspected by the Spanish Inquisition of secretly retaining some kind of Jewish practices. Beyond that, he was actually suspected in the murder of the first chief inquisitor of the Kingdom of Aragon. So he had a very dramatic life. His family was decimated by the Inquisition. He ends up financing Christopher Columbus's first voyage of discovery in 1492, which was a crazy endeavor. Everyone knew Christopher Columbus was wrong about the science. And my question that I posed to myself as this story kind of unfolded to me was, how could this worldly, grounded courtier have bought into the vision of this crazy Genoese explorer?
And so in finding his voice, how did that come about? Did it just kind of click for you after working with that first character, or did you have to kind of wander around for a bit to find it? How did that happen?
Well, the second draft was from his point of view, and I really have to admit, I didn't really have a clear grasp of who he was or how he spoke with other people or behaved himself with other people, what kind of diction he would use, or how I could fashion some simulacrum of, you know, 16th century Spanish diction. By the time I was done with my second draft, heading into the third draft, I knew that his arc was going to be, he was going to be a character who started out as very proud and arrogant, and who ends up very humble and sees beyond the things that seemed important to him at the beginning of the book. And that really shaped how he deals with other people and how he speaks.
Sure.
And how he thinks.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Mitchell James Kaplan, reading from his novel By Fire, By Water. Mitchell, would you read some more for us?
Sure. This is a short passage. In the previous passage that I read to you, Judith, who is the mother of that boy who's going to end up sailing with, I mean, not the mother, she's the adoptive mother, she's actually his aunt, and he's her nephew who's going to end up sailing with Columbus at the end of the book. At this point in the story, earlier in the story, she and her nephew and her nephew's grandfather are traveling. They're traveling from the Islamic Emirate of Granada in the south of Spain up to the capital, Saragossa, of the Kingdom of Aragon, where Santangel lives. And so there's a little passage. Near Guadix, they spread their blankets on the floor of a musty cave and rested through the day. They would pass into the Kingdom of Castile under cover of night. Baba Shlomo told them stories about the world that awaited them. "You hear those crickets, Judith, Levi? Well, in Gan Eden, instead of chirping, the crickets chant very softly like a choir in Hebrew." "But where is this place?" asked Levi. "Where is the Garden of Eden? Is it here in this world or somewhere in the heavens?" "You know, my son, it is both. In the Torah, there's the story of the land where Adam and Eve lived. It's still there, in the far east, guarded by angels and a flaming sword. Someday, when the Messiah comes, we'll be able to go back." "And what about the other paradise?" "That one is in the world to come. Only a few have been allowed to go there alive and return." "What is it like?" asked Judith. "When you arrive there, the angels take away your clothes. They wrap you in a robe of mist, and they lead you to a valley filled with rose and myrtle bushes. They give you a room on the hillside. Outside each room, there's a fruit tree. On every branch of this tree, there's a different fruit. When the wind rustles in its leaves, the sound it makes is the sound of words, and the words are more wonderful than anything we can understand here in Andalusia." Tall and ungainly, Levi fell asleep with his head on Baba Shlomo's lap, his mind full of images of a place where he would go one day where nature and mankind spoke the same language.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Mitchell James Kaplan, reading from his novel By Fire, By Water. Mitchell, one of the things I was wondering about, and I know this from reading a little bit more about your bio, that you're a translator as well, so you're someone who's worked with language, is to really think that through in terms of the historical context, and you brought that up a little bit when we were talking earlier, that I was thinking about that in terms of how to think about how to convey the language of the time and also connect it with your audience. But also, beyond language, even sensibility. You know, whenever you're writing a world, you can create, you know, whatever you want. But when you're writing about a historical period of time and there are people who thought in a particular kind of way. So I guess one of the things I'm kind of leading to is how you worked with trying to balance all of that. Were you concerned that they might seem too contemporary in their sensibilities or their language? How did you work against that? But I'm sure you also wanted to have a certain amount of that, because if you wrote it in the language of the time, I'm sure that would be very jarring to audiences. So maybe if you could talk about that a little bit.
It's one of the biggest challenges in writing a historical novel. And I think it's one of the areas where historical novelists have an opportunity to fudge and cheat their audiences, and without wanting to denigrate anyone, unfortunately it happens. Mm-hmm. And it's something I wanted desperately to avoid, but it is very, very hard. And it took me a long time to figure out how to deal with that issue. There's a book that I read when I was living in France called Mémoire d'Adrien by Marguerite Yourcenar. And it's a memoir of Hadrian, the Roman emperor. And Yourcenar said, she has no dialogue in it. She said, it's impossible. It's impossible. Now, French is a lot closer to Latin than 21st century English is to, you know, end of the Middle Ages Aragonese, but which is to say dialect of Spanish. But and her, Marguerite Yourcenar, felt that it simply was a lie to try to render into modern French dialogue that would sound faithful to the way Romans spoke and still have it be accessible to modern mm-hmm. readers. So of course, you have to make compromises, and the essential thing is to be true to the mentality as much as possible without putting off your audience. So, for example, class relations in the 16th century, in the 15th century, were much, much more rigid in Spain than they are today in the United States. The way a person from a high level in society, socioeconomic level, educational level, would treat a peasant or someone from a lower level is something that would make him automatically odious to us today. But it was universal. And the way the kind of absolute groveling subservience and the expectations that a person of a lower level would have in terms of how they're treated were also something that would be very foreign to us today. I had to somewhat reduce the dramatic kind of sense of that in rendering it for a contemporary audience,
sure,
while preserving a sense of it. Again, it has a lot to do with how Saint-Andrel evolves in the course of my story, which I think is grounded in the story of his life. In a way, I think of him as the prototypical modern man, because he has to navigate between these different identities in a world where doing so is actually a capital crime. So he's having to make all kinds of compromises himself.
Sure.
And actually, he's not allowed to believe in anything with the kind of ferocious commitment that is required of him.
Well, and I think, you know, as you're talking about it, that makes perfect sense to kind of ground, rather than trying to think about it as a system and trying to translate that system, that you ground those conflicts in a character who is an extraordinary person who might cross boundaries just mm-hmm. in his own volition. The fact that his family, he's a converso, already makes him somebody who is very aware of being in different worlds and what it means to move between those worlds.
And he actually historically had well-developed relations with the Muslim world. So here he is with a foot planted in several different cultural, religious universes that are in extreme state of conflict, and having to navigate that and still retain his personhood.
Sure. When you were doing kind of the research and getting to know him as a character as well as a historical figure and the rest of the world, were there things that you were talking about kind of from the audience standpoint that would be considered odious or unusual, hard to swallow in a certain way? Were there things that you found that were really surprising for you that you hadn't anticipated?
Well, there's all kinds of things. I mean, one kind of funny little anecdote that doesn't come up in my book, but you know, in French, the term is droit de cuissage, which is that, you know, the king in those days, or even the local aristocrat, had the right to deflower a virgin who was about to be married, peasant to peasant. You know, if he has an eye for her, he gets the first taste, as it were. There are lots of things like that, that you learn when you read, you know, about this period that are kind of shocking to us today. Most of the amazing stuff that I learned didn't get into the book. You know, there's just too much of it. And yeah, I ended up, you know, my last draft is really a matter of weeding and getting everything back to, you know,
sure,
streamline.
And I think, again, it goes to that idea of trying to provide accessibility but also authenticity. I mean, I'm sure if you put all of that in, it would read almost like science fiction, because we think that couldn't have happened that way. Would you read a little bit more for us, Mitchell?
Sure. Okay, this is when Luis de Santángel now is down in Granada on a mission for the royal crowns. He is treated to a meal and entertainment by the emir of the Emirate of Granada. That evening, amidst the flowers and fountains in the garden of the generals, the Chancellor of Aragon sat with Muhammad bin Sa'ad al-Zagal, the Emir of Granada. Beside the Emir sat his vizier, sipping a fig liquor, eating crisp pastries stuffed with squab, cinnamon, and almonds, watching a young girl called Saria perform a dance she had learned in the harem. Musicians plucked and scraped their bows across stringed gourds, blew on wooden flutes, and the sababa, a reed instrument. They struck the skin of a tambour with their fingertips and the heels of their palms. Kneeling, partially hidden behind a silk curtain, Saria at first moved only her hands in graceful flowing undulations, parabolic flourishes, and sudden sweeps. As the music grew faster and louder, she slowly rose from her knees, her head loosely swaying, her shoulders and chest twitching with the drum beats, her hands floating through the air on either side, in front of her face, behind her head, like birds lost in flight. The veils seemed to fall of their own accord from her long hair and shoulders. Her belly and hips burst into life, swiveling and thrusting, and then her legs and feet pivoting, skipping, whirling. Her body bobbed and shuddered, translating the instrument's twisting melody into one long delirious gesture. Finally, as the music climaxed and ebbed, Saria collapsed and disappeared behind the low curtain.
I think you're reading my mind, Mitchell, because my next question that I was thinking about has to do also with pulling something from your bio, that you are a classical and jazz flute player. And I'm wondering, is there something between your two avocations, the writing and being a musician, that inform each other? In that passage, there's obviously music that's being conveyed in language, but I'm just wondering if there's something about the disciplines that interact with each other.
Well, in my own subjective universe, words and music are both audio signals, aural phenomena, however you want to put it. I read very slowly, and I pronounce every word in my head when I read, and I hear it pronounced. And to me, language is music. And, you know, it's, as I say, it's subjective. What I hear as musical may not be what someone else hears as musical in language. I've learned that there are certain patterns of sounds that I like and that I don't like. And, you know, when I'm writing, I end up, if two words in the same sentence even sound in any way remotely similar, I'll often, you know, change one of the words because I want that variety of sound. And then there's, of course, there's meter and tone and inflection and the way even the frequency of your voice might rise and fall as you're reading. To me, it's rhythm, and there's also melody in words. So I don't think of them as really two distinct or different things.
Do you write poetry?
Yeah, I do.
I was going to say, you sound like a poet.
I write poetry, but I long ago decided it would never be anything that I would ever try to sell. I just do it because it's something that I enjoy doing.
Yeah, and it's funny you say that, because the writer, Sandra Cisneros, who started out as a poet as well, and she's just now finishing up a second collection of poetry. She hasn't published poetry in years. She feels poetry is too private for her, and so she feels safer writing prose, and poetry is something very personal. Can you read one more short section for us?
Okay. This takes place during an act of faith, when a man is being about to be burned at the stake. Wearing the yellow smock of shame, his arms tied behind his back, Estefan was not listening. I should maybe parenthetically mention that he's being lectured to by the inquisitor as he's standing there about how he has sinned. Or really, the audience is being lectured to. His eyes and mind were elsewhere, perhaps because he had suffered so long, or because his attempts at prayer had reached God's ears. He perceived a glimpse, or the shadow of a glimpse, of the face of God. He had never imagined it quite this way, for the face of God was simply the world before him, denuded and rehabilitated. The priest in his blood-red vestments, the words falling from his mouth, the rapt crowd below, the guards and the scaffolding, the bright cerulean sky, Estefan's own agony, and so much more, ineffable but utterly real, shimmering in the heat of the summer afternoon. He heard the whispering of angels and the quiet chanting of ancestral scholars. Behind it all and within it, a warm amber luminosity, a profound, simple, and convincing reason, which could not be summed up or expressed in words, flowed through the texture of this world like grain in the parchment of a Torah scroll.
Thanks for coming to Prosody, Mitchell.
Thank you, Ellen.
You've been listening to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 90.5 FM.